This is implausible engineering.
I
Seriously?
Really don't think so. That's never
this is
work.
Not logical.
No.
It's not true.
No.
It's impossible.
No.
That's
you
just cannot
bollocks.
Be serious.
Episode 3. We all need some space.
Well, that's just bullshit.
Interstellar travel. We imagine so much interstellar flitting about in Star Trek, Star Wars, etc., that it starts seeming almost inevitable that it will all really happen one day. So we imagine we might set off from Earth in the morning to arrive at the Alpha Centauri system just in time for tea. It is only 4.3 light years away, after all. But moving at light speed through space-time does seem clearly impossible, since the whole idea of space-time is that time is distance, and distance is time. So you can't travel any distance without time also passing. You can reduce the duration of travel between points A and B by going faster and faster, but once you reach a speed where the duration of travel reaches zero, that is as fast as you can go. And that speed is not infinite speed. It's 300,000 kilometers a second, the universe's speed limit. Even the fastest things in the universe, light and gravity, can only go that fast. On the bright side, there is still a way for you to get to Alpha Centauri in less than 4.3 years, because as you approach light speed, time dilation kicks in. Indeed, you could actually leave Earth and arrive at Alpha Centauri by tea time, as long as we mean your tea time. It will still be the case that for you to cross a distance of 4.3 light years, at least 4.3 years will have to pass back on Earth, and probably a lot more than that, since you'll never actually reach light speed, and you will need some time to accelerate up and then decelerate back down at Alpha Centauri. Of course, there are theoretical ways we might get around having to move through space-time. Some people have suggested creating warp bubbles, meaning you don't actually move through space-time, you move space-time instead, as though you are sitting still atop a moving wave. But even allowing for the implausible engineering required to create such a wave, getting it to move at anything other than a constant speed in a straight line creates a whole nother layer of implausibilities, since you will have to interact with the world outside the bubble in order to accelerate, decelerate, or turn. And then, of course, there's wormholes, seeming like tunnels through space-time, although they are really tunnels of space-time, where the space-time manifold has been shaped not just into a gravity well, but a seemingly bottomless pit. Trouble is, the only plausible explanation for such extreme geometry is that the wormhole must have some huge mass-energy density within it. And while that thing could create a space-time tunnel from point A and another space-time tunnel from point B, to get from point A to point B, you have to pass through that thing. And that thing would be something equivalent to a very dense black hole, although some would argue it would then become a white hole on the other side. But even then, it just means you either die on the way in or you die on the way out. And so, back to the first idea. You really can cross vast distances of the universe without a lot of personal time passing, if you can achieve speeds that are close to the speed of light. Trouble is, space isn't as empty as it looks, so even over the relatively short distance of 4.3 light years to Alpha Centauri, you are going to encounter dust grains, or even something bigger, and given the speed that you are going at, that will be a problem, both in terms of collision damage, as well as just plain slowing you down. So, you need something like a deflector dish, like in Star Trek. Allegedly, this projects out something equivalent to the shields, those things that can be put around a ship during combat. What exactly shields are is never clear, When switched on, they invisibly surround the ship and can take a certain amount of pounding before the crew begins counting down their decline in percentage gradations. And when it suits the plot, shields can also be projected out around other objects to protect them. And so, presumably, whatever shields are can also be projected out from the deflector dish to deflect things away from the front of the ship when it's flying at high speed. But even allowing for shields to be a real thing, the underlying physics is still problematic. Anything that pushes something out of the way will also be pushed back upon. It's Newton's third law of motion. And so if the ship is pushing out the deflector beam, then the pushback will also act on the ship. Furthermore, up near light speed, length contraction kicks in the direction of travel, so that any pushing that normally happens 100 meters in front of the ship will be happening just outside the hull when you're up near light speed. But let's say the deflector dish fires out something like a gamma ray laser, where rather than pushing things out of the way, it just vaporizes them. Near light speed, all that will still be happening just outside the hull, so hull damage is a real risk, but at least the ship will be flying through a cloud of hot subatomic particles rather than anything larger and denser. And you still get slowed down, but it's more like driving through rain than driving through hail. So, you still won't get to light speed, but this approach might get you a bit closer. All assuming you have a drive system with a stupendous amount of propellant, some kind of incredibly efficient energy source, perhaps based on matter-antimatter annihilation, or maybe you just have lots and lots of nuclear bombs that you drop out the back of the ship to push you forward. For all its failings, humanity has always been pretty good at finding ways to go faster.
Hello, Steve.
Oh, hi, Bridget.
This is your third episode now.
Yes, indeedy.
The third in a series is always hard.
Is that right?
The novelty has mostly worn off, and people are now wondering if you can keep it up. You need to show them you have a formula that's both sustainable and also novel.
Gosh.
So, in your third episode, Steve, what exactly are you offering?
Well, it's about space travel and also living in space.
Steve, it's a space podcast.
Well, yeah.
You have to keep delivering new material, you have to find new issues that will grab people's attention. Space travel isn't enough.
Well, I'm going to mention O'Neill cylinders.
I'm not sure if that will really help.
Lagrange points too.
Steve, for heaven's sake, not Lagrange points again.
Well, sure, Lagrange points. Wow!
Steve, I'm not sure a lot of people actually say wow when they hear about Lagrange points.
You'd be surprised, Bridget.
Yes, I would. So, Steve, it's a space podcast, and for this all-important third episode, you are going to talk about traveling in space.
And living in space.
Okay, living in space as well. Have you thought about trying a different angle?
Yes, Bridget. I'm actually going to talk about people living at Lagrange points.
And I suppose they'll be living in O'Neill cylinders.
You've heard it already.
Steve.
Yes, Bridget.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Space colonies. A standard theme of science fiction and science forecasting is that we'll establish space colonies one day. This is certainly possible, if not likely, but there are a number of issues to think through. Most importantly, you need energy. So, if you are going to build a real space colony that's in space, then the Earth-Moon Lagrange points 4 and 5 might be good, since they keep pace with the Moon around its Earth orbit, and so always get the levels of solar flux that the Earth and the Moon get. Or you might float a giant gondola above the clouds of Venus and get even more solar flux, or you might just do the traditional thing and build on the surface of a celestial body. The Moon is an ideal place for all sorts of reasons, although it's Mars that people generally look to. But the problem with Mars is that energy is hard to come by.
The solar flux at Mars is lower than at Earth, and it's also a bit unreliable, given Mars's propensity for dust storms, including global ones that can persist for months. So you either need some substantial and reliable battery storage, or you could go nuclear. Going nuclear would require shipping refined uranium, or maybe thorium from Earth, or otherwise sourcing these from Mars itself. Shipping a large and potentially toxic mass from Earth would be both expensive and unpopular, since economically viable deposits of uranium ore on Earth may well run out in just a few hundred years. It's likely that uranium may be as abundant on Mars as it is on Earth, which is to say, not all that abundant. But even then, it's not like you can just shovel the stuff straight into a nuclear reactor. Uranium ore would need to be refined, requiring some fairly substantial industrial-scale infrastructure. So, while none of this is impossible, it's certainly not easy, and this does make energy security another in the long list of reasons why we shouldn't send a bunch of starry-eyed colonists on a one-way trip to Mars. In comparison, establishing a colony on the moon would be a piece of cake, if not cheesecake. Positioning solar panels at the poles can provide uninterrupted solar power. The moon also has one of the most desirable qualities in any space colony, which is that with Earth only 3 days away, you don't have to spend your life there. It's not likely that any first-generation space colonies are going to have aged care facilities. So if you're on Mars, or anywhere even more inaccessible, you can expect your 70th birthday to be shortly followed by a gentle hand on your shoulder, congratulating you on a relatively long and fulfilling life, and thanking you in advance for returning your body fluids to the recycling unit, and everything else to the fertilizer plant. Anyhow, it is likely the Earth will get overcrowded one day, if it isn't already, but if the alternative accommodation is mostly unpleasant and potentially life-threatening, the only people who will choose that alternative will be those with no other options. That is, the financially disadvantaged. But then, where's the incentive to fund massive infrastructure costs in order to house people who can barely afford the rent? If living in inhospitable places using high-tech infrastructure was a solution to overcrowding, we'd already have public housing available in the Sahara or Antarctica. Of course, we do house people in inhospitable places through the use of high-tech infrastructure, but those people are generally employees supporting mining or tourism or even research. So here's what we envision. The moon becomes a huge industrial complex where you crash asteroids on the far side and then extract what you want to provide materials for the manufacturing plants on the near side. You don't want your workforce living in the middle of all that, but nor do you really want them commuting in and out of the Earth's gravity well, which would be both costly and polluting. So, high-density apartments, constructed on a huge rotating O'Neill cylinder, positioned at the Earth-Moon Lagrange points 4 or 5, would mean your workers are just as close to the moon as the Earth is, but commuting to and from home can be done without all that tedious mucking about with Earth's gravity and atmosphere. And living on the inside of a rotating cylinder gives you gravity while avoiding the space radiation issues that make living on Mars or the Moon problematic. The cylinder would be made of aluminium, which can be extracted from lunar regolith, which can also be melted down to make good bricks, and contains traces of good quality iron and titanium, so it is all quite feasible. So what are we waiting for? Well, the most important thing a space colony will need is energy, but the second most important thing will be an economic reason for being. Until then, we need to keep on making things work down here on Earth.
That was Implausible Engineering, a Cheap Astronomy production.